This has been a wild few weeks. We're talking wildfires from California to Oahu's west side to the Big Island, where firefighters are still working to protect special ecological areas and cultural heritage sites from being destroyed. A management team from California has been helping the local staff at the National Park Service as most of the blaze is within park boundaries. This week, the Hawaii Wildlife Organization is launching a campaign to get the public to take steps now to prevent the start of a wildfire. We talked to Elizabeth Pickett about it.
Firefighting is actually the last defense against wildfire. So if we've gotten to that point, we've actually missed the number of steps we could have taken potentially for reducing ignitions from occurring in the first place, or even at least reducing the impacts of fires that do start. So in 2016, more than three dozen federal, state, and county government agencies and supporting organizations came together to develop a way to keep people across the state informed about current fire and drought conditions and provide tips on protecting life and property. And that is the Wildfire Lookout campaign. And so this year in 2018, we are launching a set of radio public service announcements and also a social media tip sharing campaign for the next 8 weeks so that people can learn more about what they can do to protect their home and their family and community from wildfire.
So I imagine some of this stuff is just kind of common sense stuff.
Right. So the first thing that we think about is to reduce ignitions, which means to prevent fires from even occurring in the first place. So that means being really smart with our activities, like not pulling over on dry grass on the side of the road and putting campfire coals out cold before walking away, protecting our home and our family and our yard from carrying fire. And so the things that are included in that include keeping grass short and rain gutters free of debris, clearing brush and leaf piles, which can act as nests for fire embers. The things we're trying to get people to think about include, you know, if the wind blows leaves into the same spot near your house all the time, like a stairwell or a roof section or a lanai or even a fence boundary, a nearby fire can send an ember through the wind and land in that very same spot and start a fire. So we think it all boils down to really good housekeeping and good maintenance of your anywhere where leaves are building up. One more thing to think about is just not allowing your grass to get so tall that then it's touching branches that are coming down. You don't want the fire to get really high up into the canopy of trees because it spreads even faster that way.
And there are some areas that are experiencing drought conditions. So what can you do in those cases?
In those cases, the prevention side of things are really important. So I would emphasize, again, being really fire aware in your activities. So maintaining your equipment that might spark, being really careful with where you pull over on the side of the road. And again, doing all those things around your home and your family, your home and your yard, to reduce the chance for a fire to burn through it. And also make a family plan and practice it so that you're ready to go and leave early in the event of a nearby wildfire.
I know that there's always concern when we come out from a rainy period because then a lot of grass grows, but then when it comes to the dry period, then it's just fuel for fire.
Exactly. So there tends to be a lot of complacency when we do get a lot of rain, but that's actually a really important time to do your maintenance around your yard and to keep the grass low, because when it does dry out, you don't want to have a lot of standing fuel. You want your grass to be short, your trees to be limbed up high, all the leaf piles and everything that start to dry out around your house cleaned up, so that if fire does come through your neighborhood or your area, that embers won't land and ignite that. So actually the wet time or the wet periods are a really important time to do your prevention work ahead of time. But it's never too late, and we can get started right away to deal with the fire season that we have on us right now. Most people don't realize how big of a deal fire is in Hawaii. About the same proportion of land in the state of Hawaii burns each year as burns in the most fire-prone states in the U.S. So even while our numbers of acres burned may be lower because we're a smaller state, the impacts are broad, they're long-lasting, and they have impacts from summit to sea. So not only are people's lives and homes in danger, but we see changes to our drinking water, to our coastal waters, to coral reef health, not to mention losing things like native forests that don't come back after wildfire. So it gets put, you know, in the back of people's awareness sometimes if it hasn't occurred recently. But actually, wildfire is a really big deal, and it takes all of us to work on the prevention side of things rather than just rely on our firefighters to put out fires that we started, because we do know that 99% of fires in Hawaii are started by people. So that means that it's up to all of us to do something to prevent that.
When you talk about the threat to our native forests, I know there are many endangered plants and animals that are up in these protected areas that are then wiped out faster than, you know, anybody expected.
Absolutely. Native Hawaiian forests that get burned don't regenerate after fire the way that trees in other parts of the world do. So in other parts, they might start growing new forests right away. But in our case, we oftentimes see non-native grasses come into those areas. And those non-native grasses are extremely fire-prone. So we're actually growing and perpetuating the cycle of wildfire whenever our forests burn.
Right. So it's doubly devastating. Okay. Anything else you think would be important to emphasize? So you folks are launching this week.
Yeah, there will be radio PSAs. We're also launching the campaign with easy steps you can take to protect your home, family, community, and natural resources from wildfire on Twitter at Hawaii Wildfire, on Facebook, on our website, hawaiiwildfire.org. And in all those places, we're just hoping that people will take the opportunity to share via social media, word of mouth. We've even made each tip a standalone printable so that people can post them around your office or classroom or neighborhood gathering spot. We just really want people to know what they can do to stay safe and also to protect all of Hawaii from wildfire.
So spread the wildfire tips and not the wildfire.
Exactly.
Okay. One more thing. I know with these fires, it was probably exacerbated because we had the heavy winds that kind of associated with, I think, Hurricane Hector, which were swirling. So that didn't help firefighters at all.
Yeah. So that's actually a really important point, is that not only are we thinking about, temperature and is the grass or are the vegetative fuels drying out, but also what are the wind conditions? And that situational awareness of what's going on really feeds its way into, is now a good time to weed whack? Is now a good time to ride my ATV on this dry grass? And so we're really hoping people can connect the dots between what we call fire weather and their activities so that we can minimize how many sparks are flying in these kind of conditions.
That was Elizabeth Pickett from the Hawaii Wildlife Wildfire Organization talking about a fire safety campaign, Wildfire Lookout, that's launching this week. Tomorrow, we'll be taking a closer look at the elite unit of firefighters known as Hotshots. This past weekend, Hilo said goodbye to Brian Hughes, a member of the Hotshots team who was killed battling a fire in Ferguson, California. We'll hear more from his colleagues from his unit in Arizona, where he was based. Later in the program, we'll hear about a plan to restore a severely eroded beach on Oahu's North Shore. That, of course, is the famous Sunset Beach. The erosion began in December of 2017 after several consecutive days of extremely high surf. That surf is what originally made Sunset Beach famous. When modern surfing began rising in popularity worldwide, Sunset was one of the original big wave spots. Before big wave pioneers were surfing Pipeline or Waimea, Sunset was the premier spot for heavy surf on the North Shore. In fact, one of the earliest international surf competitions was held at Sunset Beach. It ran from 1965 to 1984 and featured many of Hawaii's surfing legends like Jeff Hackman, Ricky Grigg, and Eddie Aikau. The competition's namesake was an even more famously local personality. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know the name of the invitational surfing competition that was held at Sunset Beach for almost three decades. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
I'm Elizabeth Jensen. I'm the NPR Ombudswoman. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Summertime in Texas? Oh, it's hot.
You can't really leave the house in June, July, August, maybe even September, unless you're dedicated to going to some type of swimming pool.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. So if you want to stay home, you better have AC. But if you're going to have AC, you better watch out for the steel tariffs, because that AC unit is going to cost you. That's next time on Market Price.
This evening at 6.
Know before you go. That's the way to avoid stress when you have to deal with getting your driver's license renewed or replaced. We have a heart-to-heart with the director of the mayor's Office of Customer Service. Sherry Kajiwara says its latest challenge is the no-shows now that it's switched to an appointment system. In fact, the no-show rate is 30%, and that adds to more problems for everyone, particularly as thousands of people will see their licenses expire soon.
What we found out is that we were doing 4,000 a month back in 2017, and our research showed that in 2018 it was going to jump to 12,000 a month. That's an amazing growth in demand, and we had to find a way to meet that. So we tried to warn everybody, in 2018 the demand is going to be high, be prepared for it, and on our end we tried to develop a system that would ease the process for people. So we developed an appointment system. Just like going to your doctor for your annual physical, you make an appointment, you do that once a year. For driver license renewal, most of us do it once every 8 years. So we want to make it just as convenient. So we started appointments.
And so how's that going?
This is about maybe the 15th week of appointments. And with any new product, it takes a while for the learning curve to get over and for people to understand. So those that are using appointments are tremendously happy with it, and I get a lot of comments about how well it worked. Those that have not yet embraced it or don't know about it are the ones that are having the most difficult time. We came up with a system for appointments. We offer 13,000 appointments per month, and we still kept 7,000 walk-ins per month for those that just need it today and can't make an appointment. But the problem comes when people take more than one appointment to get their job done. Catherine, I'm still so surprised that we are in the sixth year of federal requirements to get an identification card, or a federal real ID card, as they call it. And people today still come in and they're bewildered that they have to bring in a birth certificate or a social security. And they say, since when? Of course, they haven't visited us for 8 years.
That's right.
So they don't know. And when all this came out, they probably weren't paying attention. So it's efforts like this that make people aware you need to bring documents now when you renew your card.
Okay. And all that you can find on your website, right?
Yes. So I want to share with you, I put together some tips on how to be successful with this new program. And I'd love to share it with your listeners. So what I'm going to recommend is visit license.honolulu.gov. When you go to that website, we've housed all the tools for driver licensing and state IDs into one easy website, license.honolulu.gov. Go there and use our document guide and find out exactly what documents you need to be successful. For most people, it'll be your birth certificate, a social security card, and two forms of name and address to show where you live. And then if you've had a name change for any reason, which most women do when they get married, you'll need to bring the document that shows why your name changed. So right now, if you don't know where those documents are, find them or go get another copy. Get a copy of your Social Security card, a copy of your birth certificate. You're going to need it. So I encourage people to do that now. Then 6 months before your license expires, you can start going to license.honolulu.gov and look for an appointment that works best for you. They're offered Monday through Friday. Right now we're doing Saturdays just because summer is our busiest season. But you find an appointment that works. We're telling people come down 10 minutes before that appointment time, and you should be out in 10 to 15 minutes, which is a tremendous improvement in the hour-long wait that people had been experiencing.
Right, and I know in the past, different administrations have tried to figure out how do we make this work better, how to be more efficient. And you folks have done different things, like having signs saying, okay, your wait is whatever, an hour or 45 minutes. You know, you've tried to put TVs in the area so that people have something to look at as they're waiting in line. Things like that, just to try and make it a better experience for the folks waiting in line.
Well, I'm glad you recognize that. We're constantly looking for ways to improve. And before appointments, what we did was give you a number and you sat in comfort rather than stand at length. So that was our very first improvement, by giving people chairs to sit on and a TV or monitor to watch. And now with appointments, you probably don't even have to come in until your appointment time.
So with these appointments, how are the no-shows?
Part of our problem, again, I said we expect maybe 12,000 renewals per month right now, and that's going to last into 2019. So I wanted to develop a long-term process. But we do 13,000 by appointment, 7,000 by walk-in. But we have a 30% no-show rate.
Ouch.
That means that 30% of people that made an appointment didn't bother to show up. And just take one day alone, 109 people on one day alone did not show up for their appointed time. And that means 109 people that could have been served that day, that are just dying to get an appointment, lost that opportunity.
And then were you able to make those up, though, with the walk-ins?
We do take walk-ins at that time, but there's a process that you have to call the person, give them 2 minutes because they could be having a cigarette outside or just take a while to stand up. We wait 2 minutes, we call them again, wait another 2 minutes, and then we call for a walk-in. But if you add up all those wasted minutes times the number of clerks, times the number of centers I have, times the number of days in the week, it adds up.
Okay, so it's just Kokua. When you make an appointment, you know, hold up your end of the bargain and show up, right?
So when you make an appointment, we send you a text confirmation with a date, place, reminder. And at the very bottom of that text, it says, if you want to cancel, click here. So just go back to your text confirmation that we sent you, scroll to the bottom, and if you don't need that appointment, make it open for somebody else. The other thing, and that's kind of a challenge for us, people taking more than one appointment to get their job done. So they don't know what documents they need, so they need to come back. And if everybody comes twice, that's double the appointments we need. So we need to help people be more successful on their first try. So again, if you go to license.honolulu.gov, use the document guide, gather those documents that you need before. So kind of know before you go. That will really help. Print out the application form, fill it out ahead of time, because what we have is people standing at the counter
filling it out,
and the clerk is just standing there waiting. Now, at first, we asked people to go to the back to fill it out while we helped the next person, but when they came back to the counter, people thought they were cutting, and then we had arguments.
More bad feeling.
Yeah.
More
and then,
feeling you don't
yeah,
need.
That, yeah. People just, when they've waited so long, they don't want to see anybody getting in ahead of them.
No. I lost my license, and I went down there thinking I was just going to get a replacement. And then I saw, oh, well, you need, you know, you can get the star special security on your driver's license. So explain that so okay. people know what that's all about.
So every time we think we're getting ahead of ourselves, a new curve gets thrown in. 2018, the state now announced that they'd be offering the gold star to show that your ID is compliant with federal regulations. Prior to 2020, as long as you're from a compliant state, all cards are grandfathered in. So right now, Hawaii is a compliant state, so every card until 2020, October 1st, 2020, is compliant. That means you can use your card to get on an airplane, enter a federal building, access whatever federal service requires identification. It's good. By October 1st, 2020, every card must stand alone. They're going to toss out that list at the TSA, and every card must have that star on it to be compliant.
Right, but we've got time.
You got time, yes.
Because I think in my case, I had my driver's license and my Social Security card, but I didn't have two pieces of mail with my address on it, and it was like, oh, rats.
You're right. So you're going to need those, and again, you're going to need your birth certificate or current passport, your Social Security card, and two pieces of residence, documentation on where you live. And without that, you can't get the star, so you might want to come another time. But what I do want to let your listeners know, Catherine, is that we're now offering duplicate driver license online. So if your wallet gets stolen or your card is damaged somehow and you need a new one, You can go online at license.honolulu.gov. Again, that one website with all your tools. Pay by credit card, $7, and we will mail it to the address on record with no changes.
When did you start that?
We started that maybe about 5 months ago.
Okay. So it's something new. People should know it's an easy way to get a replacement if you lose your license or if it's stolen.
Then you don't have to come down and stand in line. We're trying to give people options to not have to deal with the long lines so that we can really service those that need the face-to-face.
And I know you deal with Honolulu, which is the bulk of the population, but do you know what the snapshot is for the neighbor islands?
I understand neighbor islands have their own challenges, too, as do all other states. I understand California is trying to deal with a huge long wait period themselves. And we're trying to read up on what other states are doing to address these federal guideline mandates. And I think a lot of people are struggling with it. Now, one of the other things I think I want to point out is that with the low unemployment rate, which is great for people, it's bad for employers. We have positions that we can't fill because there just aren't people applying. And when we do offer, they turn the job down because there are just so many other opportunities out there.
Oh, so what are you saying? Like you're down clerks?
We are. People are always saying, why don't you hire more people? Why don't you get more staff? We're trying. It's just really hard to fill the positions we already have open.
How many vacancies do you have?
Right now we have about maybe 8 vacancies.
Wow, okay.
But we had about 15. We've been filling and filling in these last 6 to 8 vacancies. We make the job offer or they stay 1 or 2 months and then they leave for something better. So it's always a challenge to get more staff.
Okay. All the things that you have to deal with when you're trying to provide a city service, important, critical service.
Yes, and then I want to also point out that let people know that they can renew their license 6 months prior to expiration, and you'll still keep your birthday. A lot of people think that they have to come on their birthday because they want to keep that birthday trigger date, but you can do it 6 months in advance. So we tell people, go to license.honolulu.gov, start looking for an appointment 6 months from that point on, find a date that works for you. Make sure you get your name and your address on document, like letters, that you can use for this purpose. So a lot of women, their husband's names are on the utility bills. Take 2 of those bills and put them in joint names, Mr. and Mrs., and then both of you can use that document for federal purposes. Women should open a bank account. Put $100 in a Christmas savings account with your name and address. Save that for when you have to do this identification process. Same thing for youth. If your kids are going to drive, they don't have anything with their name and address. So open them an account. Put the cell phone in their bill. Maybe make them pay for it.
There you go.
But have them gain some accountability as to where they are, where they live, and those documents will help them.
That was Sherry Kajiwara with the Mayor's Office of Customer Service. And she has this tip. It may be faster to go to the main driver's license center than a satellite city hall office because in those smaller offices, there may be only one clerk handling licenses. And when it comes to eye exams, if you have a letter from your eye doctor saying that you're under his or her care and that your eyesight has been corrected, it may also allow you to skip the eye exam at the DMV. The department also has a hotline set up to assist those who have their licenses expiring soon. Look for links on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Nick Kurosawa is one of record label Aloha God Soul's newest discoveries. This young soul singer and guitarist brings his original tunes and classic covers to HPR's Atherton Studio on August 18th. Call 955-8821 during office hours or go to hprtickets.org and experience his heartfelt voice in a perfect acoustical setting. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. We just got past the primary, but Marcel Henri gives us a preview of what's going to appear on the general election ballot. Morning, Marcel.
Aloha, Catherine. Good to be here.
I can imagine Scott and his team are just like, barely catching their breath, and they have to look forward to November.
They've got to turn right back around and dream it all up again.
Exactly. So what's on tap?
Well, we're looking at a few key things that could come up. Foremost is a proposed constitutional amendment And the language is a little vague, but it's basically something that would allow the legislature to raise a tax surcharge on, quote, investment real properties in order to support public education. There's also a potential constitutional convention. Now, every 10 years, this comes up on the ballot for voters to decide whether we need to hold a constitutional convention. Should they decide that we do need one, that could open up a whole other host of potential constitutional amendments as well. You're talking possibly term limits for state legislators, citizen ballot initiatives, changes in union requirements, even somebody pointed out a potential single-payer health care language. All sorts of things would be on the table.
Right, and we haven't had one of these in a while.
I believe it's 1978 was the last one. So, yeah, that would be a big deal. A lot of people look at constitutional conventions as a way to kind of bypass what happens at the state legislature. You're not happy or you're frustrated with the pace and progress of things there. It's just one opportunity, but it's also a double-edged sword, right? It all kind of depends on what comes out of that convention.
Right, and then the counties will have a special language on the ballots as well. Explain that.
Right, so they're looking at charter amendments, and we are seeing some proposed charter amendments coming out in all of the counties. On Oahu, for example, there's one that would look to fix these quorum and voting issues that have plagued the HART board, the rail board, for the last year or so. Actually shorter than a year, ever since the state added four non-voting members. It's made it difficult for them to pass some things. It even jeopardized a potential multi-million dollar fix with HECO. So they need to fix that there.
Right. And you've been covering all those meetings. So you see the delays.
Yeah, I see it kind of play out firsthand. So they're really hoping that they can fix this and kind of resolve these quorum issues. There's other stuff on the neighbor islands as well. Maui has a proposal that would basically boost the fines on illegal vacation rentals from $1,000 to $20,000 to really try and disincentivize that. There's some interesting things happening on Kauai where they might repeal the public defender on the county level because they feel it's redundant to the what's available for the state office of public defender. And they might also strip the council the ability to create a public an electric power authority based on there already being the Kauai Island Utility Co-op. And basically, if you're satisfied with that, you know, that they've been doing a good job is how the charter amendment that's what they're proposing, that they should strip that the ability.
So, and yeah. The Big Island also has something, too.
Big Island, stay tuned. I checked in with them, and they said they're still working out language on what they might present. The deadline for all of these charter amendments is August 23rd, as well as for on the state level with the constitutional amendments. So after August 23rd, we should have a clear idea statewide and in all of the counties what will be on the general election ballot.
Okay, and hopefully our voters will bone up because, it takes a while to read some of that language on those.
There's a lot of education necessary. Yeah, it's true.
Right. Okay. All right, Marcel, thanks so much.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, I'm Gavin Swain from HMSA, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's being hailed as a solution to save Sunset Beach thanks to a private-public partnership. Work began yesterday to take down damaged portions of a bike lane eaten away by beach erosion during high waves. Jeannie Ishikawa is the deputy director of the Honolulu Department of Parks and Recreation. She explains what's involved with the restoration project.
At Sunset Beach, the Department of Facility Maintenance is going to begin removing portions of the damaged bike path in that area. When that is done, then the Department of Parks and Recreation will be going to Sunset Beach to begin the sand restoration project, meaning that we will begin pushing sand from Palmalu Stream over to the front area. The sand will be pushed by the mouth of Palmalu Stream, so we will have heavy equipment there, so everyone should be mindful of that and be careful. So the heavy equipment will be pushing the sand towards around the bend to restore the sand dune area. So we anticipate, depending on the weather and the surf conditions and the waves, you know, it could be a couple of days or it could be the entire week, but we are looking at next week for getting this work done. We want to make sure we're doing this in a very, in an ecological way so that we can help preserve the beach park. We're asking everyone to kokua and be mindful of the sand and foot erosion that takes place. The more people go there, the more sand escapes. So we ask that you be mindful of the sand that sticks to your feet, to dust it off, bring an extra towel, leave the sand at the beach. And we're hoping that this project will give good results, that we can look at implementing it at other beach parks.
The North Shore Community Land Trust has partnered with the city to complete the Sunset Restoration Project. Executive Director Doug Cole has spent the last 40 years on the North Shore's beaches. He said changing sand levels is normal, but the current seems especially concerning.
Over the last 40 years of just being on that shoreline and surfing and swimming and walking along it, it's my whole life, like, it's been fascinating to watch the sand move. Like, in where I grew up, in the summer the beach gets really big. In the winter with the west swells, it gets washed away. There's other areas where it's the opposite, where the summer and the trade winds erode it away, and then the winter and the west swells bring the sand back. And so you grow accustomed to just seeing the sand move, and that is normal and that is natural. But what we've seen the last, like, I'd say 5 years is a heightened level of extreme erosion, you know, in a few particular places. And, you know, I've come to think of it as, like, Maybe we're trying to view this as, like, 1 to 3 year cycles of sand movement, but maybe it's, you know, decades or 50, 60 year cycles of sand movement. You know, it's hard to know what this shoreline would have looked like 70 years ago. I know, like, 5 years ago, there was an incident where it was worse than I'd ever seen in my life. So at that point in time, in over 30 years, I'd never seen it this bad. And then we noticed that there was, like, these old telephone pole, like, seawall sort of structures. And we're like, well, I guess it was that bad at some point in time because somebody put that there along the shoreline. And so it's hard to say, like, whether or not what we're seeing now is the worst it's ever been, but it's the worst it's been in the last probably 50, 60, 70 years. And so that's really alarming. And when you couple that with the fact that sea level is rising, it's hard to think that, oh, it's going to get better, you know? And so I think it's something we need to learn more about. And I don't think we've really put in much effort at all to learn about it. And the best, most knowledgeable people when it comes to this are probably the surfers and ocean fishermen and users that have been doing this for decades and walking these shorelines. And we need to reach out and talk to them and start building our knowledge base.
Now, the Land Trust has been working on other dune restoration projects around Kahuku Point. Volunteers will be applying lessons learned from those projects to Sunset Beach.
We've been doing a whole lot of coastal sand dune restoration work at Kahuku Point the last 3 years, so we've learned a lot about what works in the shoreline environment and what native plants thrive. And so what we'll be doing in partnership with the city is coordinating volunteer work days to outplant natives, to put up educational signage, and to put up symbolic fencing to help protect the planting and the sand dune. And hopefully begin educating the public on the appropriate and thoughtful way to interact with the shoreline. What's crazy is out at Kahuku Point, you might have a dozen people, plus or minus, walk along these trails on the shoreline out there in a given day. We've been putting logs along the trails just to, like, narrow the footprint of where people walk. And then the grasses fill in up to those logs, you know, just a little bit of symbolic fencing. And that, for me, was really eye-opening because I realized, like, oh, just a couple dozen people walking around out here every day has a significant impact on the vegetation's ability to grow. When you take that knowledge and you look at Sunset Beach, where you have literally thousands of people every single day stepping onto the sand to take a photograph and then stepping off, the vegetation has absolutely no chance of growing in those areas. And so what we'll be doing is working with the city to create a few designated access points with symbolic fencing around the other areas and planting native vegetation that does well in the coastal environment.
Now, Sandy Beach is one of the most vulnerable sections of our coast here on Oahu. But across the island chain, Maui and Kauai are also at risk. Sea level rise and surge potential are other factors identified in a recent study released by the University of Hawaii. The study looked at coasts on 7 of the 8 main Hawaiian islands. We talked to Yaprak Ona, one of the 4 co-authors on the project, which found that 30% of our shorelines are at high risk.
The most vulnerable areas are found in the North Shore area and also Ewa Beach, but also Kailua. So what is very important and alarming here that the high exposure zones are found in the highly populated areas. So that's why the study emphasizes the need for improving the adaptive capacity of those areas. What we also see for Oahu is that the coastal defense structures are protecting the coastal shorelines of Oahu almost about 30%. So that doesn't mean that we need to concrete everywhere or build anything without doing a good environmental assessment, but any kind of a design strategy that can be done for that Oahu shoreline can be done using this study and see what is the vulnerability assessment and what kind of adaptation options that you can propose. Actually, we did that using this study. We did that for a local zone in the North Shore region from Pupuke'a Waimea area to the Sunset Beach. We decided the vulnerability of those areas and proposed an adaptation solution that is most balanced. What we try to do is to display a very good initial picture of what is the exposure of the shoreline of the Hawaiian Islands. We also make all of our data available to anybody who wants to use it. So researchers can use our raw data and build on it in our model, and also any, you know, concerned citizens can reach our static and interactive maps, which are total about like 70 maps, so that they can see whether our region is in the high exposure zone and which factors are influencing the exposure in that area.
That was Yaprak Onat, a UH researcher whose study released this summer identified areas at risk for sea level rise and erosion. Onat told us that Sunset Beach is one of the worst areas she visited while doing the statewide shoreline survey. To find links to the story, check out our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm songwriter Tim Rose, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Now we have the answer to today's backyard quiz. Today we asked you to name the invitational surfing contest that was held at Sunset Beach from 1965 to 1984. For much of that time, it was the premier competitive surfing event in the world. Winners of the competition include several of big wave surfing's early pioneers, including Eddie Aikau, Jeff Hackman, Ricky Grigg, and Clyde Aikau. Now, entry into the contest was by invitation only, making it the daydream of many a young grom in Hawaii and elsewhere. Now, the competition was named after one of the most well-known Hawaiians anywhere in the world, Duke Kahanumoku. In fact, Duke even presented the winning trophy for the first 3 years of the contest until his death in 1968. But his name lived on for the next 25 years in the Duke Kahanumoku Invitational Surfing Championship. And congratulations to Brandon Martin from the North Shore. You got it right. That's today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Now that the Boy Scouts of America has decided to open its doors to girls, the Girl Scouts are ramping up to make sure families know the difference between the two groups. We sat down with Sherry Chang, the executive director of Hawaii's Girl Scouts. She also used to sit on the board of the Boy Scouts, so she brings a bird's eye view.
One of the interesting stories about Girl Scouts in Hawaii is that Girl Scouts from day one was an all-inclusive organization. And a teacher at Kamehameha School for Girls recognized that Hawaiian girls in those days, these are the early 1900s, were considered girls of color. Girls of color couldn't belong to any national organization except Girl Scouts. So she contacted them. She wanted the girls to be a part of it. They signed her up. She became Troop 1. Another troop started soon after in Kaka'ako. And Queen Liliuokalani actually sponsored both Troop 1 and Troop 2. So we were the first Hawaiian girls. We also brought in the first Chinese girls, first Japanese girls. Hawaii was really at the forefront because we had Girl Scouts here before California even had Girl Scouts.
So really it's an incredible history.
Yes. We celebrated our 100th anniversary in Hawaii last year.
And so what is it about being in an environment with all girls? Because I went to an all-girls high school. But explain to people who maybe don't understand why that's so important.
In order for girls to develop the confidence and their leadership capabilities, it's really important to be in a supportive environment that actually advocates for that and teaches them skill sets on how to deal with competitive situations and how to fend for themselves and how to step beyond what their comfort zone might be. A good example is in the STEM field. Girls, especially in Hawaii, when they reach middle school, start faltering in math and science. And the reason is not because their brain power isn't the same, it's they don't have the confidence in themselves. So we think it's extremely important. We start STEM building skills in kindergarten for young girls. We hold major events and do STEM professionals throughout, bringing them in to teach the girls all of these different skills, because that will help them. It's been proven, the national research, that it proves that they not only are more confident in their own capabilities and abilities, but they actually do better in school. They actually earn more money when they go out into the workforce. They're better citizens. They vote more. They do a lot of things that are very positive. So it's really important for us to keep motivating them and getting them involved in an environment where it's a very safe environment, but an environment where they can actually grow leadership skills. And that's what they're going to need when they go out into the workforce. In the last 10 years, Girl Scouts, STEM has been one of our major pillars of education. We have our outdoor experience and adventure. We have our entrepreneurship and financial literacy. We have our life skills, and then STEM. And the one thing that we've made a commitment as a national organization is in the next 10 years, we will put 2 million young women into STEM career opportunities. They will be the workforce of the future for STEM.
How are you looking at the situation where the Boy Scouts are opening their doors to attract girls?
It's more of an education process, I think, with parents. There are some not so great recruiting tactics that are going on that are confusing people and giving false information out. And I think it's really important if the parents really understand and have young girls understand what the challenges that girls learn differently, the way they develop their emotional skills and everything are a little bit different than boys. And that's what the Girl Scout program addresses. And the difference is we have national research that backs up our entire program all the way from kindergarten up through 12th grade. The Boy Scouts don't have that. They're throwing the girls into a boys' program. Well, that's not going to benefit the girls. That's just throwing girls into a boys' program. Our program is specifically designed to help the girls develop skill sets that will help them on leadership and other issues that they'll address when they get older. When you look at the results of Girl Scouts, when over 80% of today's current female tech leaders were all Girl Scouts, over 90% of every female astronaut was a Girl Scout, 100% of every female Secretary of State, 76% of every senator was a female senator was Girl Scout, and over although two just resigned recently of the Fortune 500 companies, unfortunately, but of the female leaders, over 70% of female leaders in Fortune 500 companies were Girl Scouts. That shows you that there's something about that program that gives girls that confidence that they can achieve anything and helps them get outside that comfort zone.
I was reading some of those articles, and the concern was with these women CEOs stepping back, that there was still the glass ceiling.
that's one of the things, and I certainly encountered that in my career several times, but we teach the young girls about mentorship and support systems. If we actually have videos for the older girls on how to work in business with other women, because we want them to be supportive of each other. You can be competitive but still be supportive. You don't have to stab someone in the back to get ahead. And that's another thing that we do try and work with the girls, to be help each other out. And mentorship is so important in Girl Scouts. And when we bring in at our STEM Fest, we bring in 119 STEM professionals. 99 of them are women. And we do that on purpose. We want those girls to see role models that they can too achieve what these women have achieved. And so that's another situation that Girl Scouts is really strong in. We are the world's largest girl leadership program. We also are the world's largest girl entrepreneurial program in our cookie program, because that's more than just selling cookies. But we have already gone into the 21st century with all of our programs and everything. We've developed national partnerships with NASA, with SETI, with Palo Alto Networks, with Raytheon. We're actually teaching from kindergarten on up about cybersecurity. We're teaching from NASA and Raytheon about astronomy and space. The future is all going to be about information technology, and so we want these girls to be ahead of the game, because not every school, unfortunately, goes beyond robotics when it comes to STEM, and there's a lot more to STEM than just robotics. So we incorporate all of that into the programming for the girls. So these national partnerships, when the North Face comes out and actually just signed a program nationally with Girl Scouts and is working with us in Hawaii to develop more adventure programs for girls, they said, we see the future explorers of the world being female. Palo Alto Network said, if we had to look at the ideal employee who would be designing the defense security and code for the United States, who would we pick? They said, Girl Scouts. And so they've developed an entire program with Girl Scouts for that now. So we know we're progressive, we know we're innovative, and we are able to bring these partnerships in on the local level as well to help our young girls take advantage of it.
You know, we talk about the glass ceiling, and there were just some headlines about a school in Japan that was lowering the scores of their female students because they just thought there were too many women applying to be doctors.
Well, and I think that's what's so important about the differences between Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. I mean, Girl Scouts has always been about helping young women develop leadership capability and to move ahead. That's not the case with Boy Scouts. Girls weren't even addressed until this year. So you have to look at the subtle nature. What does that messaging mean? And the messaging is, maybe girl leadership isn't what they're as concerned about as Girl Scouts is. We are concerned about that. We want them to be the future leaders. And if we come in with the numbers that we're coming in into the STEM fields and everything, we will be the leaders. We're already the leaders in so many of these other areas. I mean, to think of 80% of current female tech leaders, we're all Girl Scouts. I mean, that's telling you that entrepreneurship, that ability to go beyond the norm and stretch your imagination and do things differently, they've developed those skill sets for Girl Scouts. This is a kind of a funny thing. So when the Boy Scouts made the decision to accept girls, one of the first calls they made was to the cookie manufacturers to see if they could also sell cookies.
Really?
And that just told me they don't get it, because it's not about selling cookies. It's about developing 5 business skills. It's developing money management, financial literacy, goal setting, people skills, business ethics. That's what the cookie program. We actually have Cookie University here in Hawaii. We have some of the top female leaders in Hawaii come and talk to the girls and teach them these skill sets, which they then use in that cookie program. So it's a program. It's not a fundraiser. It's a program. They were looking at it just from the monetary. But see, that's the difference in how they're looking at things. And it's very irritating to us that happens. But fortunately, the cookie manufacturers have said no so far. So let's hope they keep that way.
Is there anything else you want to share just about, let's say, businesses that establish some kind of pipeline with the Girl Scouts organization?
Well, I think that's one of the great things about these new national partnerships, because we're bringing them to the local level. Like, we're currently working with NASA, and we're currently working with Raytheon. We're currently working with a lot of these organizations. But even simple things as at our STEM camp, we have entomologists there all the time. Well, one of our girls just got an internship during the summer and now a scholarship to college to become an entomologist. One of our girls last year ended up with and she was at a very good private school, but she was not on on the STEM track. Everything she learned about STEM was through Girl Scouts. Well, she ended up being at Cape Canaveral as an intern last year, is becoming a biomedical engineer, getting scholarships. I mean, it's actually opening up more doors for girls than they would come across through their schools and their normal networks. One of the great things that Girl Scouts develop is we have one of the most sophisticated technology platforms for volunteers. I've never seen it with any other nonprofit organization. So we bring in our leaders. Even if they weren't Girl Scouts, it can plan out a year's worth of activities for them, teaching them the supplies they need, the, you know, all of the activities that they need to do to keep that interest in the different programs. There are some leaders who are more adventuresome than others, and so we remind the parents that if this isn't the right fit for you, we'll help you find the troop that fits you if you want to do more adventure scouting and things like that. We are very big into that as well. And that's where the North Face has come in with 12 new adventure badges for the Girl Scouts.
And then in this day and age when we start to see a lot of the schools go co-ed, you know, which had been, you know, single gender, you know, what does that say about the Girl Scouts?
I don't think it says anything. I think that's why we are a great complement to those schools, because the girls, what they can't necessarily achieve in school, they're finding a support system in Girl Scouts that helps them reach beyond what they might be able to in school.
That was Sherry Chang, head of the Girl Scouts of Hawaii. For links to information about the program, head over to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we learn about beekeeping in the tropics. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page, again at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.